you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
How are we doing, everybody? Welcome back. We're here again with John Wedger and, of course, myself, Ron Swanson. We're here again looking at crime theories, asking the tough questions about crimes that have affected the whole world. John Wedger is ex-police, and his expert knowledge is fascinating on so many cases. And there's some things he can talk about, and there's some things he can't. And it's a fascinating situation when we have an insider like this breaking down crime. And, you know, how are you doing tonight, John? How's your week been? Tell us a little bit about how you're doing.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, the weather's been very, very good. You know, and I do my hence swimming against depression. And so for me, that's got a lot easier. So I'm going, you know, I've been since Christmas Day going around the country, swimming in my underpants in open water locations in the UK and Northern Europe. And it's been phenomenal. And I do it to promote the unparalleled benefits of cold water therapy, especially when it comes to the treatment of things like depression, PTSD, and suicidal tendencies. So for the first time, I'm starting to feel warm. A lot of people, if they swim this time of year in the open sea or in a lake, they find it cold. Whereas for me, it actually feels quite warm now because my body's, it's changed. So I did a swim at the weekend, and I'll be doing hopefully one in a couple of mornings' time. And I'm really loving the onset of summer. It's a fantastic time.
Yeah, I bet. And I just want to point out for anyone who's maybe a little bit unknowledged, swimming in your pants in winter in the UK is no fun. To believe in something like that and to really put your heart and soul into getting your voice heard on that topic is incredible. But to do it in a way that benefits so many subcategories of people, like you say, anxiety and suicide is amazing. So can't wait to hear more about that, John, and can't wait to see some footage and really see the movement moving behind you. So, but tonight we're back with some crime theory, and we're going to be delving into two cases. One is Madeleine McCann, and the other is the Dunblane shooting that occurred in Scotland. And John has some fantastic information on both these cases, and we're of course diving into the latest Madeleine McCann news, where there's been some updates and some new investigations that are happening in the case. And John, would you like to just take it away and let us know what has been happening in the world of the Madeleine McCann case?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I was I conducted an interview with Sean Atwood a couple of months ago regarding the Madeleine McCann case, and it's something which is the British public are obsessed with it, and you've got to ask yourself why are they still pursuing this, and the millions that they've spent on it is phenomenal. So there's a lot of things that just don't seem right, but what we've seen with this case is that this week they started the search again for her body. So we're looking, I think it's about 15 years since she went missing. She would be, I think, about 20, 21 years old by now if she was about. And so they've conducted a search in a lake.
On the edge of this reservoir, 30 miles from the resort where Madeleine McCann disappeared, there is now intense search activity. An operation acting on fresh intelligence, enough to convince investigators the area could hold the key to helping solve this 16-year-old mystery. Using ground-penetrating radar and specialist sniffer dogs, search teams concentrated on this relatively small and very isolated area. It's a spot where Christian Bruckner, the prime suspect in Madeleine's abduction, visited on a regular basis. He'd lived for a time in a commune just 7 miles from here. This search operation is being conducted by the Portuguese police, but at the instigation of the German authorities. Germany's chief prosecutor, who's investigating Christian Bruckner, says he has compelling evidence that he not only abducted, but murdered Madeleine McCann. German authorities have never detailed that evidence, but almost a decade on from the last major search on the Algarve, it's taken them back here with a renewed determination. The German chief prosecutor confirming that a detailed tip-off had brought about this latest operation. Although Christian Bruckner's defence team have continually called into question the evidence against the convicted rapist, the lead prosecutor is a highly respected figure within German law enforcement. A small number of Scotland Yard detectives are here in Portugal monitoring the progress of these searches, relaying anything of note back to Madeleine McCann's family in the UK. Mark White, GB News at the Arran Dam on the Algarve.
Now, for me, as an investigator, I will be looking at water as being a place used to conceal the body. Now, you've got the Algarve coast, which is quite a rugged coast in parts. And the things which are going to hinder, if you're going into the criminal mind, what would hinder getting away with disposing of a body? Because we got all sorts of offences here, and one of them would be the concealing of a body. Would be that you wouldn't want a body cropping up in a trawler, you know, because you've got the boats that do trawl the seabed, and so they would pick up if something's been dropped there. And the other thing are recreational divers. So a recreational diver, you don't want them coming across a body either. But the things which would prevent that from happening would be if the body was put anywhere sort of with a depth greater than 50 metres would pretty much rule out a recreational diver coming across it. And if it's a rocky seabed, then you're not going to get a trawler boat going over there because it's going to snag the nets. So anywhere sort of out the reach of recreational divers, and really that the sort of like the terrain, the topography of the seabed, that would put off a trawler boat picking up a corpse. And the sea's a huge, huge place. And also when we look at search teams, you know, when you're doing terrestrial searches, you're doing it on land, you can use sniffer dogs. They're an incredible resource to the police. And they can pick up a scent, which is ironic because, you know, there was a lot of conjecture, especially where the family were concerned regarding the ability of the sniffer dog used. And that's something that I really want to go on about if I can. But sniffer dogs are brilliant. As an investigator, I would use dogs for as many things as you can. And, you know, these dogs, detection dogs, they can be used to sniff out money. De La Rue's, the money makers, put a chemical in the ink, which gives off a scent. So money actually gives off a scent. Again, drugs, cocaine. And what it is with cocaine, they smell for the chemicals used to refine it, the alcohols that are used to refine cocaine. An interesting fact, these passive sniffer dogs, they're trained to sniff the thigh area of a person. Because after someone sniffed coke, what they do is they tend to wipe their hands on their trousers.
Oh, there we go.
And so the dogs, when you see these passive sniffer dogs in nightclubs, they will walk up and they will sniff the thigh area of a person, and they will passively just sit down next to a target. And that's how and people tend to stroke the dog, a little spaniel. God, cute little thing. And that is an indicator or a knock, as they call to the handler. this person has got drugs. And the dogs are good because they don't know how to lie. They have not got the ability to lie. There's no deception in a dog. It does its job, and they've got incredibly finely tuned sense of smell.
Yeah,
but when it comes to a cadaver, bodies, they rot very quick when they're in the fresh air. So when people bury a body, it's only really to conceal it. It will really slow down the decomposition procedure, and certain soil types, can actually preserve a body as well. And they found that with the recent case with a lot of the bodies that they found in Northern Ireland. I think they uncovered something like 50 bodies on a beach.
Wow.
During the Troubles, and some of them were really well preserved because the soil actually preserved them.
No, just
other soils.
I just want to ask you something about the Madeleine McCann. So, if let's say, for example, she was dumped at sea, right, or dumped or dumped in water. If we're talking about the sea, surely that can't be. I mean, we'd have to rule out deep ocean because she would just be pulled apart and eaten. You know, she would decompose and she would be eaten.
If she's
in a bag or something like that, or buried, I'm assuming that must be what their theory is. I mean, that has to be what has funded this new investigation, is the theory that she's buried somewhere, or she's in something. And been put in the water.
Well, they'd have to weight the body down because a body floats twice.
Of course,
I mean, I spent a few years working on the river police, and one thing that they were brilliant at was recovering dead bodies. The Thames, if it was like a borough in London, it would give up more dead bodies than any terrestrial sort of area. It worked out. A body a week, a suspicious death a week. You'd be hard pushed to match that, even in the most violent of London districts.
Yeah,
and water, that's crazy. Water just destroys the DNA. It bloats the body. A body will float twice. Initially, it will float, and then it will sink, and it will go down. Now they're searching a lake. A lake is sedentary, so it's not going to move. So the body will go down, and there will be predation. You're going to get shrimps, you're going to get eels, crabs, and all sorts of things that will go into. And of course, also the body will decompose very quickly in the water. It will fill up with decomposition gases, which will make it buoyant. The skin starts to go peel off. And a white person, their skin goes black. And a black person, their skin goes white. It's a very strange phenomenon. And then it starts to fall apart, and it will lift because of the huge amount of decomposition gases caused by the bacteria and everything else. And the body will float, and then it will pop, and it will give off the most wretched of smells. It is the most pungent.
Yeah.
Disgusting odor, and I challenge any seasoned person who's worked in this environment not to throw up. If you're not used to it, oh man!
The smell of death is one thing.
Comes back to me.
But
this is worse. When
a popped body
at sea.
I spent some time working for. I spent some time working for the Royal Lifeboat Association, and the smells, I mean, some smells linger even when all traces of that smell have been removed. I remember when, sadly, bodies were brought into our Dunbar Harbour, and the smell lingered in the harbour just for days.
Of course, yeah. And if it's the summer, it's and bear in mind Portugal, it must be. I often think about when you see footage of countries such as Rwanda, when they had, the meltdown in that place of the civil war with the Tutsis and the Hutsis, or whatever the two warring factions were, and they showed you the streets just lined with corpse after corpse in an equatorial climate. I mean, the smell must have been the most repugnant you can imagine. It must be absolutely appalling out there, and the disease that goes with it. But so the body will lift up and float, and that's when they tend to be detected. Tidal waterways are slightly different. You get movement in a tidal waterway. A river goes in one direction, so a body can be taken along. And we've seen that with this bizarre case of this Nicola Bullen, the lady that went missing in Lancashire, and the body was, I think, the River Ripple. And a body was found a mile away from where she allegedly went in. It's a very, very strange case, that is. And there's a lot of question marks I have for that job. But if it's a non-tidal river, then there's a chance if the body is buoyant that it could be taken. If it's deep enough and got a strong enough flow, that it could be taken a long way. Again, predators will move the body. You know, if a body goes on a bank, you could well get things like otters and
even
foxes dragging the body out. And they found that with the case of little Sarah Payne.
Yeah.
You know, foxes had started to eat and also consume and also move her body. So you get that. And you also got that during the 7/7 bombings. Body parts, the flesh was actually taken by carrion crows. They thought it was a free meal, and they were finding the search teams, the abseiling search teams that the police had, which I was a member of for a few years.
Okay.
And you know, they were recovering bits of flesh on rooftops and in nests and all sorts, because the crows were taking it away. So nature will have a lot to do with it.
Yeah, heavy tidal impact, waterways, of course.
A tidal waterway is slightly different, because what a tidal waterway will do is the body tends not to go too far from where it's dumped. So the River Thames, if a corpse is thrown in South Westminster Bridge, there's every chance that the body will get taken under. There's a lot of eddy currents, and the ebb tide will take it out. But then the flow, when the tide comes in, will push it back to its original place. So it to and froze with the tide, and it tends to not go more than 10 metres away from where it originally goes in. But what happens is the body gets agitated and it gets moved, and that causes an erosion as well.
Yeah,
of course. And damage to the corpse. Yeah, and boats will do the same. So if a body goes up and a boat hits it, a propeller's going to slice it in pieces. I mean, you see it with propeller damage to sea mammals such as seals and whales and dolphins, you know, quite often they will have lacerations where they've been hit by outboard motors and things like that. And the sea is full of predators. You've got lobsters, crabs, and, you know, the bottom feeding fish, and, well, fish in general. We'll really find a big meal in there.
Yeah.
And also, when you've got confined spaces, search teams, which is what these police teams will be, they'll be underwater and confined space search team. If you've got a murky environment, you're going to rely solely on feel and touch. So it's a very inaccurate science. They go in like a concentric circle motion, where they start off in the middle and then they sort of go around in a circle and slowly, slowly spiral out from a given site. And again, it's very difficult. It still comes back to basic skill sets anyway. I mean, it's like a lot of cases that they might have the most advanced technology going, but when it comes down to a court just wants statements, what they call Section 9 statements. And it wants written down evidence and tangible evidence. And if you haven't got that, then it doesn't get allowed in. So the police might fool with the forensic science thing. And forensic only means evidence for a court. That's all that means. That may advance, but it comes down to base level court rules. And if you don't satisfy them court rules, then they're not going to get heard. And if they do get heard, they're subject to scrutiny. And if you haven't got the evidence, then you're not really going to win the case. So, but it's going to be difficult. If they're searching this lake and the visibility is poor and it's a big lake, and we're talking now 15 years, you know, in the water, well, good luck with that one. And you know, if it's on land, at least a sniffer dog, and you've got ESDA machines, you know, these geophys machines, which can pick up any disturbance in the soil. So they'll find if a grave's been dug and things like that, and they just go over. They roll them over the land, and then they analyze like a sonar footprint and see if the land's been dug. And then you can put a sniffer dog in there. Cadaver dogs are fantastic. And what they do with the cadaver dogs, they'll drill holes in the soil. They'll do a series of holes, and they'll put a dog over it. And if that dog indicates that there is, a human cadaver down there, they'll put another dog over. And if the dog gives the same knock, then it's pretty yeah. much guaranteed that there is a corpse there. Again, it's incredibly time consuming.
Yeah.
And, and that's on land. And so how they're going to do it on water, well, you haven't got that ability. And it depends how deep that lake is.
Yeah.
The family seemed confident when they did the statement analysis of their testimonies that no one would ever find her body. And I'll base that evidence on the findings of Peter Hyatt when he was asked to transcribe some of their interviews, and he indicated deception in their narrative.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were aware of where the body was, and they were confident no one would find it. And for me, considering that, the topography of the land and where they are, coastal, rough Atlantic Ocean, that there's every chance that body is in the sea. And that's the statement I made. My assumption and my findings were that the body will be in the sea. And they're pretty confident that no one will find it.
This will be your fifth birthday without Madeline. Each year before, Kate and Jerry McCann join us now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. This will be your fifth birthday without Madeline. Each year before, you've marked it with a small party, cakes, balloons, cards. Is that how you're going to remember her today?
Obviously, it's slightly different today, George, because we're launching my book. There will still be a little tea party at home and balloons and cake with Sean and Emily and close family and friends. I think I comfort myself by knowing that what we're doing today could be very positive in the search for our daughter.
And as you said, all of the proceeds from this book are going to fund the search for Madeline, because this has to be done privately now. Police aren't doing it anymore.
That's right. The police investigation stopped in July 2008. So we've had to get our own team of investigators, and obviously we have to fund that ourselves as well as the campaign.
What we hope with the book launch today, George, though, as well, is launching a campaign really for an independent review of Madeline's case by the authorities, something that's never been done. And for us, that's a major stone that needs turned in the search for our daughter.
In the book, you base it on the diaries, Kate, that you've kept for Madeline. It is so raw and honest about your pain. And what you did as a couple, there are points where you're actually blamed by the police. One point, the Portuguese police basically offer you a deal. They say, if you just take 2 years in prison, confess to accidentally killing Madeline, this whole thing will be over.
I think it's hard to explain how terrifying that whole experience was. It looked like our whole life was going to collapse around us. And I'm sure if we had confessed to hiding Madeline's body, for which there's absolutely no evidence, and no evidence even that Madeline's been harmed, that would have been the end of it. Kate was incredibly strong through that period and was fighting for Madeline.
I think the most difficult thing, George, was the realisation at that point that the police weren't looking for Madeline, and that they were just focused really on trying to, I guess, blame us and for it all to be over. And obviously that is, one of the most damaging things that could then happen to the search, really, was for the police to stop looking and to convince the general public as well that we were somehow involved, and then stop them from looking. So that was the thing that hurt the most.
You also write about, though, you had left Madeline and the kids there. This, and my wife and I have talked about this. This could happen to anyone. But how were you able to stop blaming yourself in any way?
I mean, all I can say is how much that I love Madeline. We both love our children dearly, and there was no way we'd ever have put them at risk. I think I have to remind myself as well that the person who's committed this crime is the abductor. And at this point, that abductor, that person, is out there free. So he's got away with this so far. He's also free to go and, you know, commit similar crimes if he's left as it is, if nobody's going to bother to try and look for him.
And finally, what's your biggest hope of what can come from this book?
Well, obviously, our main hope is that it'll lead somehow to us finding our daughter and for us to be back as a family of five again. And we'd like to thank everybody as well in advance that have helped us already. Thank you to everybody who'll read the book. And please keep looking. Please keep helping us to find our daughter.
And thank you for joining us today.
Maybe I'd still go with the open water. I don't think they're going to find that body. I don't.
Well,
I don't think they're going to find it. And I don't think anyone will ever be convicted of it either.
This is just coming in the last hour. Police officers investigating a Portuguese reservoir in the searches for missing Madeleine McCann have zeroed in on woodland area. So, the Mirror saw officers on site using strimmers and chainsaws to remove dead vegetation and aid their search. Four police dogs were also spotted, and German officers were seen loading evidence into the back of a Ford Ranger truck. And that was at 5 to 8 this evening. So, very interesting that they've utilized what you said, what you think would be best, which is the dogs. They're strimming an area now which is clearly not underwater, it's on land, and they've been seen loading evidence. What that evidence is, who knows? By the time this shows out, maybe there'll be some breaking news that we're talking about next week. But this all stemmed from this lake, and they seem to now be focusing on the surrounding areas as well, based off of dogs' findings. And we'll just have to keep an eye on this one, John. You know, I tell you what, just since this is a theory show.
Yeah,
just since this is crime theory. What do you, and you've probably said this loads of times before, but just hit us with the Cliff Notes short version. What is in your honest opinion, okay, this is John's opinion, what do you think happened, and how could she have ended up in that lake?
Well, I don't think she's in there for a start. And if she is, my opinion, and I base this on many, many factors, and again, it is opinion, this isn't any fact, is that the child died in the apartment. It died through overdosing, sort of too much residual sedation. Through okay. medication. I think the child, when she was in the apartment, woke up under heavy sedation, which was given to her by the parents. She may have stood up to try and look on the back of a chair or something, try and look, find out where her mum was. She was badly coordinated because she was you know, given a lot of knockout drops or whatever, and she's fallen. And she's mortally injured herself, and she's been a fatal injury, probably a broken neck or something like that. And the parents have done everything to cover it up. Now, one of the suggestions is that Madeleine may have been sexually abused. Now, if that is the case, this is where it gets interesting. If Madeleine had been sexually abused, right, there will be a need to get rid of her body, because there will be a special post-mortem. There's two types of post-mortem. There's a standard post-mortem, there's a special post-mortem. That's in the UK. I don't know what Portugal does, but I wouldn't have thought it's much different. You know, most countries, developed countries, do go along the same system.
Of course.
So that will be that her body would have been cut from top to toe, and it would involve an examination of every single part of it, which would include, you know, the sex organs and things like that. Now, if she was being sexualized, again, we don't know if she is or she was or whatever. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, if we base this on the assumption that she was, then that would be relevant, right? That would be picked up, and then the placement of the other two children, the twins, would be in question then, right? Because that would instantly launch a child protection investigation.
Can I just...
So they stand to lose all their children.
I think for me, I believe that theory if there is an abuse element tied into it, because for me, like, the whole theory of her falling off the couch and breaking her neck, right? I've seen a baby, right, fall off a kitchen counter and hit his head off the floor, okay? It's a traumatic experience, and I've seen it happen. The baby was fine. Like, the baby was absolutely fine. And I find it hard to believe that she would have fallen or something. But the whole residual drugging or accidental overdose, that is 100% likely. You know, that is very likely. Yeah. And can I ask you, what is the legal, like, mileage from a coast before it becomes international waters? Like, how far do you have to take a boat out?
12 miles.
Really isn't far, be honest. It really isn't far.
Which isn't far. And if you're taking, like, a little pleasure cruiser, or even if they had access to a powerful rib boat, I mean, a rib boat can easily do 30 knots, so you're going to cover that distance very, very quickly. But if we just go back to the point you raised, look, people can be hit by a 70-mile-an-hour car, get up and walk away. Others can be hit by a push bike and die. You know, someone can fall off a
block of flats. That's very true.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
And survive it. People have fallen out of plane. Others have fallen off the curb, banged their head and died.
Yeah.
So it's one of them things. I think it was an awful tragedy that occurred. I don't think the kid was murdered in a malicious attack. I think it generally was an accident, but
yeah,
it would have highlighted a bigger picture, in my opinion. And I think this whole thing of them sitting around, and then she goes back and sees the kids missing. There was something like 40 questions unanswered. And, you know, why? I haven't got my research stuff with me, but.
Yeah, that's okay.
You've seen more about it in Sean's interview I did, but, you know, I haven't been a parent myself. If your kid's missing, you're all going to be screaming and shouting and running, she's gone, she's missing. There was none of that.
Yeah.
And the Sky News was contacted very quickly afterwards. Well, why would you even consider contacting them? Yeah. Why? And it seemed to me that, again, is my opinion, that whole evening could have been manufactured, and actually the kid was long gone and disposed of by that time.
Yeah.
And the story was all got in line and everything was worked out. And an experienced detective who that Concalvis guy seems to have been, he knew that they weren't telling the truth. That's my opinion.
That's your opinion. Well, I'm going to
many things that
I'm going to play devil's
sense to me.
Yeah, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I'm going to throw out what I think. Again, theory here. I honestly think that there had to have been, if it was an accident, all right, and there had to have been some sort of drugging involved that was the reason for the cover-up, okay, if we're thinking nicely here. So I'm agreeing with you if I'm thinking of the nicest possible thing that could have happened to that poor girl was her dying in her sleep, okay, through an overdose. But honestly, there's way too many connections to very bizarre, twisted things that I can't even talk about on this channel, but there's two individuals that were in Portugal around the same time that tie in with very powerful people. Some of you who understand what is now seen as a conspiracy that broke a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, concerning the Clintons.
Clinton.
Yeah, the Clintons and her emails.
I mean, we're not saying that these people.
No, we're not.
May or may not.
No, this is just a theory.
They may or may have been involved in some sort of wrongdoing, but it still wouldn't have taken from the fact that this all went very badly wrong.
Why is there no CCTV, John? Is this the only hotel in the world with no CCTV? Because why is there nothing? Why is there no last seen footage of her, if you know, anything? Why? I mean, it's so bizarre, yeah,
Well, it may be back then it wasn't as prevalent as it is now. I mean, now, yeah, of course it will be everywhere and people have it, but, you know, we're going back a few years and it wasn't that big. I mean, it's the first CCTV that we started really seeing in London was in the Borough of Westminster. It was around the Pimlico, Belgravia area, and that was sort of circa 1996. And then slowly, you know, it started being used more and more on a commercial level after that. So it's a relatively new thing if we look at capturing footage. Now it's everywhere. Buses solve murders. The 16 cameras on a London bus. Just a big walking camera or driving camera and things.
I believe there's some darker things at play with the parents. And this is all theory, but I genuinely would not be surprised if we found out this was the offering of a firstborn for some very peculiar, dark reasons. Like, honest to God, that's where my mind is with it. I really, really think there's something dark and very, very twisted in this whole story. I think that it was just another day at the office for the monsters involved, and 12 miles off of the coast of Portugal is where the truth lies, and sadly, we'll never figure this out.
Thanks for watching our podcast. It's with my sponsor. It's AG1 by Athletic Greens. So, Jen, as a pregnant woman, taking AG1 in the morning, how's that helped you?
Well, with the low energy I've been having due to being pregnant, AG1 has helped give me that morning boost that I've really craved.
Bear in mind, if you are pregnant, consult a doctor before taking AG1. Jen and I get AG1 delivered every month, which makes it super easy to have as a daily habit. With the single serving travel packs, I never have to miss a day. Just mixing the powder into the water, drinking it first thing every morning before breakfast. That simple.
If you're looking for an easy way to take supplements, Athletic Greens is giving you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Go to athleticgreens.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N. That's athleticgreens.com/Sean. Check it out.
That's the word from our sponsor. Thanks for watching. Link in the description box below this video for AG1.
Yeah. The one thing I would say about that is that if we look at Satanism and satanic witches, you know, it's been going on for a long time, and there's never really been prosecutions for children that have been killed in it. So if these people are that powerful and that connected, why have they screwed up so monumentally and brought so much heat and attention to themselves? That would seem the most stupidest thing to have done.
I can give you a stupid theory on that. So I believe that the group that run this all around Europe come out of Amsterdam, and it centralizes in the ports in Amsterdam, and the boats leave from there. I believe their whole club runs non-digitally, so it's Polaroids and VHS tapes, and that's why it's a lot harder for the media to distribute, and it's a very tightly niched club. I believe that the reason this is so public is because the group thrive on that. You're talking about the ability to make a huge case public, and they get to sit on their twisted boat thinking to themselves, how stupid are the rest of the world that we have got 13 million investigated into a family who gave up their child, allegedly, this is a theory, and we're just sitting back laughing about it. Obviously, you come from a more grounded, rational point of view, but for me, that fits into the whole agenda.
Yeah, no, I don't think these people want the attention. They want the attention at all. I think they want the opposite from that. And I think this is something that's gone tragically wrong, and it's brought attention to them. And everything has been about crisis management and damage limitation from that point on.
Well, and that's the beauty of this, John. You can rope me in from my crazy theories, and it's easy to sort of get caught up in conspiracy when it's something like this. Do you not find that?
Yeah. Well, it depends where you come from. I mean, look when it comes to the world of sex abuse and child abuse, and people that have been damaged by it, there's a need for justice. And unfortunately, only 2% of these historic cases end up in what we would really class as justice. And so that there is an anger, and there are people that do have a lot of complex mental health issues, and it's easy. And also a lot of people that are medicated very heavily throughout their life because they suffer from depression and disassociated identity disorder and things like that. And paranoia can come in, and unbalanced, unrational thinking can come in as well. A lot of the time with crime, it's stupidity and incompetence.
I cannot love Madeline more than I love her. You know, I would never have taken a risk. It was something that wasn't even a decision. That's how safe it felt, you know.
What information did we have to suggest it wasn't going to be safe? We were dining 50 yards away. We were making regular checks. We were going into the apartment, always quiet, every night. And if we had thought it was unsafe for a minute, if there was any conscious element that somebody was going to go into that apartment and steal your child, then of course we wouldn't have done that.
But I mean, it wasn't just a matter of being unsafe, was it? I mean, is it the case? You can clear it up right here. Now, was Madeline upset the night before about being left alone? Had she had a moment and got out of bed and started crying and started looking for you?
I mean, I don't want to dwell on it too much. I mean, I don't know if you saw the documentary last night, so I mean, I have talked about it. Madeline made a comment in passing that, where were you when I cried? Not just to mummy, by the way, just generally. It just seemed a bit odd. I mean, it was a very kind of passing remark, and we just thought she doesn't usually wake up, and if she woke up, that means that, you know, she must have fallen back asleep very quickly. And then she moved on. You know, she moved on.
Anybody with young children will understand that children cry, they wake up at night. During that week, there was one night, and we can't give too much detail because it's part of the investigation file, but there was one night when Madeline had come through and one of the other twins was crying. So, you know, and when she did mention it to us and we asked her about it, and she just dropped. She was completely fine. And we thought, was it when they were bathing, getting them, you know, first putting them down in that period when they're really tired? Of course, with hindsight, in the context of what happened, of Madeline being abducted, it's put in a very different light, and it's put in a very different light to us, and of course we emphasise that.
If Madeline hadn't been abducted, we'd never have thought of that comment again.
And it isn't as complex and as conspiratorial as people think. I'm not saying that doesn't go on, because it does.
Of course.
It clearly does. 100%, and I got caught up in that, so I know.
Yeah.
When it goes wrong, and they need to nail someone, you know, they really pull out all the stops and they will do a Rolls Royce job on you. But most of the time, it's not. It's just laziness and incompetence, and quirk of fates occur. But when people sometimes aren't that balanced, they can go with sublime thinking and irrational thinking. And some of it's, you know, isn't qualified talk. There's an interesting thing about aviation disasters, and 90% of them are human error. I mean, there was one in Brazil where a plane crashed into a mountain, and they were blaming all technical issues and all that. And what it came down to was a pilot and a co-pilot were watching a football match instead of navigating their plane. And they crashed into a mountain. So it comes down to basic human error 90% of the time.
Do you know, it's weird you mention that, because working with Phil Chalmers, he investigates and is an expert on serial killers. It's shocking how many serial killers have been caught because of a brake light, and there's a body in the trunk and a brake light's out, or there's a road. They've done some minor traffic thing that's got them in trouble. The amount of luck that comes into a lot of the cases is not... It's shocking, because you would hope there was a big supercomputer that the police just pinpoint with all their evidence and it does it all for them and they're never wrong. But the amount of luck that comes into some of these big cases is staggering. We now maybe we're going to see a shift from the lake into the forest. And if anything happens, you can rest assured that next week we will do a follow-up on this.
So the police search of an area in Portugal near where Madeline McCann went missing 16 years ago has now come to an end. The search had already been extended from 2 days to 3. Our Europe correspondent Siobhan Robbins is at the scene of the search and can bring us the latest. Siobhan.
Yes, the search, as you say, appears to have ended. To bring people up to date, we've been here over the last 2 days, and at this reservoir on the peninsula behind us, that's where we've been seeing the main hub of the action that's been going on here. So we've seen, for example, sniffer dogs being brought in, cutting machines clearing wooded areas, drones going up, police officers digging. And this was all on the request of the German authorities, who have named their prime suspect in the disappearance of Madeleine McCann in 2007 as a convicted sex offender called Christian B. Now, it's understood that they asked for these searches, which have been done as a joint effort by the German authorities, the Portuguese, and with some officials from the UK. The reason they asked them, we understand, is because they got a credible tip-off from an informant. Christian B has always denied any involvement, but it's thought that he used to visit this place, so they've been back here. And over the course of this day, we've seen a lot of the heavy machinery that was used in those searches coming out. We've also seen down the road, an HQ which was set up with various blue tents, that's all come down now. And we put in a request to the German prosecutor to see what was happening. And he said to us that the fact that the search teams seem to be leaving, that everything is packing up, would suggest that the search is over. But important to underline, that doesn't mean the investigation is over, because what they need to do now is look at anything that they may have found here, find out if it moves the investigation on or if it's something to discard, and then also continue to investigate what happened to Madeleine McCann. Now, we're hoping to get some sort of confirmation that the search is officially over, although from what we can see, it clearly is, and also maybe later in the future, find out from those prosecutors if they have found anything credible to move this investigation forward.
And Siobhan, I know you're there at a remote reservoir in Portugal, but, you know, such is the focus of attention still on Madeleine McCann 16 years on. What's been the level of interest on what's been happening there over the last 3 days?
Huge. It's been absolutely huge. As you say, this is a remote area. It's a place where signal is difficult, winding roads, and all of the roads are absolutely packed with vehicles. There have been people bringing in satellite trucks. There have been crews from around the world here. And we went to Praia da Luz, which is where Madeleine McCann disappeared from in 2007. And it's what people there are talking about as well. We spoke to tourists who have been coming back to this area for decades, who were in the area at the time when Madeleine McCann disappeared. And they said everyone's talking about it. It's on the front pages of the Portuguese newspapers. And for the tourists that we spoke to, certainly they feel like this is a new opportunity really to get answers, because this search that's been happening is the first one back here in Portugal for almost a decade. And there's a feeling that hopefully there'll be answers for the family in due course, but also for the people living in this area where the case has just hung over them for 16 years.
The next thing we're going to talk about is the Dunblane shooting, which happened in Scotland. Very tragic incident. And this was something that I was a little kid when this happened, you know. I had family friends who were working for the NHS that worked literally on the victims of this. And it's a case that I think nobody in the UK or Scotland, if they grew up when it happened, has ever really healed from, because it was so outrageous and devastating. And we're going to touch on that because, again, John's got some really interesting insights. You've heard about just how on point his theories are with the Jill Dando case, which we talked about last week. If you haven't seen last week's episode, there is a link in the description, and this will be all in a playlist. So make sure you go and listen to that. But take us through what happened at Dunblane and your theories on why we're linking it with the McCann case. So I hope you guys are ready, because John, like I say, just so interesting. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, the Dunblane shooting, it was classed as a Dunblane massacre. And I actually remember it breaking. This was the day after my birthday, actually. It was on the 13th of March in 1996. And it's a little town, the Dunblane Primary School, in the town of Dunblane, which is near Stirling. And a guy called Thomas Hamilton shot dead 16 pupils and a teacher, and he injured 15 others. He then shot himself, allegedly. It was the deadliest mass shooting in British history. And it brought about big debates on sort of the gun laws and gun controls and everything else in this country. And it was And Thomas Hammett was a very strange man indeed. You know, he had, there was rumours that he was a paedophile. He had links with the Scout Association, and he was linked to youth clubs and all sorts of things. I think I've got to check this up because I'm not really done too much in-depth stuff into it, but I think that he did have some sort of connection with Gordon Brown.
Well, as you can imagine, this has been a long, dark week, full of tears. Dunblane is still in mourning. However, the evil that came last week is gone. The children returned to school today. And this is a very important day for us, because today marks the beginning of our recovery. And you mark my words, we will recover. I promise you that. I've been walking around the school this morning, and I came across a group of children who were laughing and joking together. I went round another corner and I found a couple of kids who were arguing. Normality is returning. We have really only one priority now, and that is to ensure that our school becomes a happy place of learning once again. And with the help of all the people in Dunblane, whose strength this week has been just truly remarkable, and with all the good wishes that we've had from everybody from all over the world, we will be a good school again. Personally, I've been totally overwhelmed by the flowers and the cards, the letters, the offers of help, and not least the thousands of teddies. It's been quite daunting trying to read these, but I can tell you that every message and every offer of help has given us a little boost. So, on behalf of the pupils, on behalf of the staff, and indeed on behalf of Dunblane, I thank you very much indeed for that, from the bottom of my heart.
And I think, again, I will research this and come back to you, but I think Gordon Brown also had links with Jerry McCann, and they were from the same sort of district, same area. There's some bizarre connections going on, but... Right, so, I mean, I've got information. I'm not going to go into the source, but this guy had come out of the military, and he had connections to someone that was at the school on that day. And what he told me was that of course, there was, you know, one teacher was shot and 16 pupils and 15 others injured. And a lot of the women teachers were shot in the back, because they actually shielded the children, but the male teachers sort of ran away, and the women had this natural sort of thing to be like, you know, the mother goose and protect the flock. And what was said to me was that Hamilton's intentions were to go into the school once the kids, because the kids go into their classrooms first. They go to the reception into their classrooms. They do the register, and then they all file off to the hall for an assembly, and it happens every morning. So I was told that his intention was to go into the assembly when the kids were there and shoot all the children in the face. This is what a twisted guy, you know, he was. And there was a kid that was late for school, and Hamilton saw him going in and wanted to verify the time with the child. And so he asked the kid what the time was, and the kid lied, because the kid thought he was some sort of official from, you know, the truancy board or something, and lied about the time and said it was actually sort of earlier than it was. So Hamilton went back and waited an extra 5 minutes or so. By that time, the kids had left the assembly hall and gone to their classrooms. So he'd missed that vital opportunity that he wanted to massacre all the children and shoot them all in the head.
Wow.
in the assembly hall. So he then had to go from classroom to classroom shooting the children, which didn't give him the desired effect he wanted. That's what I'd heard about that. And the strange thing with that there was they put 100 years, it was Tony Blair put on 100-year Dean notice on it, you know. And Dean, that's a defense notice, which is a tool of the military intelligence services. It's not a civilian police tool. So they've put this 100-year rule on, and we see this a lot with the child abuse care home cover-ups. They were putting 30-year, they did that, was like I said, with the Jill Dando thing, they put these Dean notices on it. Now, you see this a lot when it comes to sex crime.
Can you tell us a little bit about what a Dean notice is?
A Dean notice is a defence notice, and it was brought in during the First World War, and it was this sort of loose lips sink ships. It might, if my memory serves me well, I think it was Winston Churchill brought it in, and it's to do with reasons of things that for national security, and so it's a government notice, and it's usually sent to the media, so they withhold information for reasons of state security, and it's a defense advisory notice, so D notice. So and it's a tool of the military. So it's very strange that they would bring that in. And that's what we have it. You know, they
so. What exactly does the D notice in conjunction with the Dunblane case mean? Like what just because I'm clearly an idiot.
There's obviously something to do with that case which involves national security. There are rumours that Thomas Hamilton was the file. Now, if that's the case, the old information, he certainly had connections to the Scout Association and to local youth clubs. And he's a strange man, and you see the same. There's a case... if you go back to the 80s, of Michael Ryan, who massacred a load of people in the town of Hungerford. I think Hungerford is even Berkshire or Wiltshire down that way. And he did the same, went and shot a load of people. And there was all bizarre stuff around that. Again, a very strange man, Ryan and Thomas Hamilton, very similar, you know, odd, very quiet, classed as loners. No one really knows much about them.
So can I just ask as well, let's just say, if you were a politician and you were super friendly with somebody who committed a massacre and you wanted to sort of make sure that never got out, I take it a D notice could be put in place because if that, you know, if a politician's associated with it, that could affect the national security. And I know that's twisting the reasons to use a D notice, but could that have been a reason for it being in place on the Dunblane case to save someone's skin connected to him?
Well, without a doubt. I mean, it was created in 1912 and in the run-up to the First World War. And it was to do with the press really getting information and leaking it, which would assist the Germans.
Okay. I mean, don't get me wrong.
So it was put in, in a state of war, and it's been used ever since. And we see it a lot as an instrument that gets used to silence the media around child abuse.
Wow.
And its cover-ups in organised kids' homes and established children's homes. Especially ones that you know, there was a prevalence of abuse throughout the 50s, 60s and 70s. And it comes out a lot. And again, you had the thing around place, the guest house, Elm Guest House in Rocks Lane, in Barnes, on the banks of the Thames in sort of southwest London. You know, all bizarre cover-ups and denotices going about around that thing, because it was alleged that there were politicians involved in the abuse of children in
that
place.
That's quite a scary concept.
A few survivors of that kids of that guest house that were taken there and were abused.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard a lot of information that's come my way from survivors that I've interviewed, mainly post my time in the police. And I've heard of members of the royal family. I've heard of many politicians, Crown Court judges. I mean, one guy, he told me about a judge that convicted him and sent him down at Crown Court. And it was the same judge that used to, when he was younger, used to come into the children's home and abuse him.
Wow.
You know, it's such a disgusting, appalling state of affairs. And we see these cover-ups. Now, a very strange thing. In the same sort of policing district, we had the Dunblane thing, but then we also had the Lockerbie bombing, where the plane, the Pan Am plane, came down in the town Lockerbie in Scotland. And I think it was the same chief constable dealt with both critical incidents. You know, what bad luck has he got?
Yeah.
And they arrested and imprisoned a guy called Abdul Al Megrahi.
Yeah, he's innocent.
I spoke to a guy that was in prison with him and said, John, he's an innocent man. He never did it. And I said to him, I can't remember which prison. It was either Socton or it was Barlinnie or Gwynedd, one of them prisons. And I, I spoke to quite a few inmates at these places. And he said, look, this guy is innocent and he doesn't get a hard time because he's well-liked.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
But wherever he goes, he's flanked by two officers. He's never allowed anywhere on his own, except to go to the mosque. And then the officers are with him even then. So even when he goes to a shower. So he was totally isolated from every other prisoner and not allowed in any sort of dialogue with any other prisoner. This is another thing we see with the Rule 43 and the segregation units. In the prison community where they put the sex offenders. And I can see for a protection point of view why they do it, because these people are a threat to the safety of both themselves and the staff. And there is a duty of care no matter how abhorrent these people are and their crimes are. But also, if you get a load of sex offenders together, they're going to form their own community, which they do in these prisons, and they share stories, which they do.
Of course.
And it was one of the reasons why we weren't allowed to give transcripts of ABE interviews, which were the child abuse interviews. We weren't allowed to give them to the defence teams unless the case was fully in trial. They could come and they could listen to the tapes, because these transcripts were getting traded in prisons as a pornographic dialogue. It's sick. But when you've got these communities all together, if there is a paedophile that was procuring children for politicians, which is the inference regarding people like Sidney Cook and things like that. That may well have been the case. It may not have been. Again, it's just an inference that I'm drawing here and an assumption that I'm drawing. Then that information stays with them and it doesn't get out into the public domain. But if one of these prisoners was in general population and did manage to survive out having his testicles cut off and his throat cut or whatever, you think of the source of information, he could give other prisoners about people that were involved in paedophile rings.
Yeah.
It would be phenomenal.
Do you know?
I mean, they would know so much.
Do you know, John, you just talking about that, It's exactly the same. And to put it in context for people, if you're a fan of fishing and you go on a Facebook page where people are talking about fishing, on the dark web, the child abuse communities, it's the same enthusiasm for what they're into that they talk about with this stuff. And they're constantly educating new like-minded individuals on how to conduct themselves better and all the rest to stay under the radar. And in the same way, if you put 20 people that are all into anything together, they're going to come out of it more educated on that topic than when they went in. And it's shocking hearing that the transcripts are used in that way, and just how twisted these individuals are. And can I just dial this back a bit? Because when we're talking about the D notices and we're talking about Dunblane, if what you're saying is right, the individual who massacred these kids, if he was connected to any politicians and he was a monster who went after kids, it would be quite a quick fire way of silencing and keeping your like-minded political friends safe from public knowledge, right? And that's really quite shocking and interesting. And let me just ask you this. Do you think if Savile was alive and all of this broke when he was alive, we would have seen a D notice on that?
Well, very interesting. There's a very good interview that Tony Gosling, the former BBC journalist, does with another journalist from the West Midlands, and it's to do with Savile. And this journalist tells Tony Gosling that he had information that Savile was an asset, an informant for the intelligence services. And that would make sense to me, especially as someone who was a source recruiter. So part of my toolkit in the police, because it doesn't matter whether I'm being conceited or not, I was very tell me things, and that was utilized. The police utilized it, and they utilized me to recruit informants. And some of that was very covert. It could be very dangerous work as well, not just for the source, but also for myself. And it can go very seriously wrong. And there's very strict parameters around it. But if we go back to when Savile was very active, 50s, 60s, and 70s. So this guy's had decades and decades. He's almost half a century, maybe more, of proactive paedophilia.
Do you think there's a possibility then that Savile may have been a pawn being used to gather intelligence on people that were into the same thing as him?
Yes.
And he got away 100%. With it because the people that were letting him get away with it were more concerned with building blackmail material or...
Of course.
Wow.
This is what you've got to realise, that the intelligence services, with certain information, there's a need to bury it, but they don't bury it because it has blackmail worth. And then it can then control global politics. So
exactly.
If that's the case, then that is going to be a concern to state security. Hence the reason the military intelligence get involved, and hence the reason D notices get served. Now the golden rule with informants is that you can work them. They can, but providing they give information greater than what they're involved in. So if that is greater now.
Yeah. Of course.
Then Savile being a child rapist, what is he getting information on people doing?
Correct.
Child murder?
Yeah, correct.
I mean, if we look at, you know, that it came out in the inquiry, Operation Conifer, that Ted Heath was an active Satanist. And the information I've had regarding people that were involved at that sort of level, that the child sacrifice is used and it's highly values. In their rituals, because there's a demonic need for blood, so and child blood is especially valued. So that's the only thing I can think of that's been worse than child murder, in whatever context that used, whether that is for sexual gratification or for demonic worship.
So just for the viewer, it's fairly suspicious that this D notice was put on to the Dunblane massacre. It's clear when you hear John's answers to the theory that if Savile was a pawn and he was gathering information, it would have had to have been worse than what he was doing. So, for example, you've got a guy who's, you know, selling a bit of green and he's giving up people that are selling a bit of brown. That is a good working system for, you know, the police to catch bigger fish, if that makes sense. So there's clearly no other reason than hiding something that connects to a darker incident than massacring a bunch of children at play here. And if we're talking about politicians in the UK at a time where there was, you know, Savile was running rampant, who's to say that the individual that caused this massacre wasn't part of a bigger operation and plan and went completely rogue? And the information and the individuals he's tied in with were too big to be brought down. It's a scary concept.
Look at the behaviour of this guy. And so he came to notice of the police in Bannockburn. There was a child protection unit, Bannockburn, in Scotland, and Hamilton was named in there as being of concern to child protection because he was involved in a residential holiday camp for children.
And they
were so concerned, the police, that they recommended that he had his firearms license revoked. And this was in 1991, and neither Hamilton's propensity for liking an unhealthy sexual liking of children, the information regarding that was never followed up, and neither was the recommendation that he got his license revoked, and that came out in a government inquiry on him. The government inquiries, these inquiries are very important. People dismiss them. They're an inquiry, they're not an investigation, so no one's going to get nicked by information. When you investigate things, right, you're always looking for a way in, and people will always tell you something. Even if they're lying to you, they will tell you something which is going to be a way in. You're never going to get the full hands up and I want to tell you everything. It's rare. It does happen, but it's very, very rare. But what you've got to do is cherry pick, and you get little golden nuggets, and sometimes they do leak out and they do get out into the public domain through these government inquiries. And they're just a little opening into a darker world.
Of course.
So when we're looking at the early 90s, you know, a good 5 years before Hamilton massacred these children, there were already concerns by the police that this man was a danger to children and he was too unstable to hold a firearms license, and nothing was done.
But do you think maybe if there was a bigger story at play here, just for a second, it works out better for them that it wasn't revoked, because it just lays more blame and more distraction for the public to focus on rather than following a line of question that could lead to things they don't want to know coming to light?
Again, yeah, Hamilton, he had Masonic links. That came out as well. And this is also why the government love a conspiracy theorist, because when conspiracy theorists go to work, you know, they get unbalanced with their viewpoint, and they can easily mock them and dismiss them as nutters. But, you know, sometimes with some of these conspiracy chat rooms, there's some good information in there, but people take it too far.
Yeah, well, I think
and then it gets discredited, and that's the problem you get.
I think as long as the crazy outweighs the correct theories, the government are happy. You know, as long as there's just enough crazy out there to put people off believing the realities, and we see it with everything. There's genuinely people that still think that planes were flown into the towers because some dudes in a cave put together a whole plan by themselves. No help at all.
But the other thing is 80% of the American population, when asked, they don't believe the official narrative of the Kennedy assassination.
Listen, do you know what? It's not the two towers that fell down. Let's just agree that it was the guys in the caves. Sure. How did the building 3 fall down? No plane hit that.
Oh no! It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, I don't believe that official narrative for one minute.
Bonkers.
It's just scandalous. These things are designed not to collapse.
Correct.
And there's been a lot of who's a woman, Judy. I can't remember her full name. She's a structural engineer, and she lectures on it, and she's done a fantastic book on why the towers fell down.
Yeah.
The 100-year rule is this:
Here is a word from today's sponsor, Aura.
If you Google someone, you can find out all kinds of personal information about them. This information is accessible because of data brokers who profit by selling your information to robocallers, telemarketers, spammers. You can use my link, https://aura.com. Aura is A-U-R-A. /Sean Atwood, S-H-A-U-N-A-T-T-Wood. To try 2 weeks for free and see how many data brokers are sharing your info. Also linked in my description box on this YouTube version, or scan the QR code on the screen.
Aura also monitors your emails and passwords to see if they were involved in a data breach and exposed on the dark web, and gives you the recommendations on what to do.
Aura has almost every internet safety tool you'll ever need, all inside one app.
And that is legally the age of a human being, right? So in the eyes of the law, a human being could be expected to live 100 years.
Okay.
So therefore, anyone involved in that information will be dead. And
correct.
Therefore, it's okay to name them and everything else.
Correct.
So that's why they do it. That's why they put a 100-year rule on there to protect the children, they say, and everything else. But
and just to reiterate, the reason why this is important is John has already clarified that so many child abuse, trafficking, and cases that happen in care homes involving children have these D notices attached to them. Now, you'd think they would be the last case in the world you would attach a D notice to, because it involves kids and we want the truth. The same with the Dunblane massacre. And the discussion we just had about Savile brings this whole thing together and circles us back to the McCanns, because it's interesting, after learning about the D notice, it's changed my opinion a little bit, because you'd think that that would be a case where they would throw a D notice on it if there was any connections to politics. You'd think people would be silenced, all the rest of it. In the same way as I think Savile would have been D noticed and silenced. So
yeah,
when I look at the McCann case now, it kind of makes me think twice a little bit. Maybe it's different rules for Portugal, but I don't know, because it's such a big case. If we did a D notice in the UK and then some information came out in Portugal and then we couldn't report on it, would that be more suspicious? Do you see how many conundrums this causes now for trying to come up with a theory in my head? Because I can't decide on what happened to Madeline. I've got a theory that I agree on every theory. Did she, you know, was she accidentally overdosed? Did she get sold? Was she stolen? I've got something I believe in all of them. I just don't know which one I believe out of those that I believe to pick and say, this is what I think. It's just too big.
Well, I mean, you know, the average time spent investigating a missing person is 36 hours, right? That's the average time. So they've spent 15 years on this case, £15 million. And I think the average amount of money is something like £1,200.
Yeah.
You know, we still have 1,500 unaccounted for long-term missing people. In a year, 70,000 reports of missing children. Now, that's not saying 70,000 children go missing every year. A lot of these are parents that are a bit overzealous, overprotective, and report the kid missing. Most come back again. Kids' homes when kids abscond from care, which is regular.
Yeah.
They think they're down as a missing person. They always present themselves back again.
Yeah.
The reasons for them absconding could be a lot more nefarious, and we could be looking at organised grooming involved and sure. things like that, which is a case, especially in the investigations I took part in. But most come back. So to say 70,000 children every year go missing and they're never seen again is absolute nonsense, which I do hear come out of the mouths of certain people.
Yeah.
If that was a case in 10 years, you know, I mean, what, 700,000, you know, not short of a million children. I
yeah.
mean, really, it's we wouldn't have any kids left if that as how it was. But again, that still leaves 1,500 missing people gone out there. They seem to have spent, you know, a ridiculous amount on this case and a lot of time and resources, especially when it wasn't even their jurisdiction. it was a Portuguese police's jurisdiction, not the British police's. They had no jurisdiction out there at all. And then I think the police came up with an adequate conclusions to what happened. Yeah. And the suspects, in my opinion, are the same as the Portuguese police, which is it's the parents. Now, what went on in a deeper level or a more sinister level regarding the parents and their friends, yeah, that could be subject to a bigger argument. And I'm open to some of the theories that are out there. But when we're taking the nuts and bolts of it, you know, I think that this was a quirk of fate. This was something that wasn't meant to have happened. And they have covered it up. They've used all their influence and their connections to cover it up, but not just to do this, the crisis management as well. We're looking at, there was a thing come out the other day that Philip Schofield has been spending in the past few months, £30,000 a month on crisis management teams. Well, why would you do that? And there's rumours that he's got a super injunction out to stop information about him and this. This young lad as a runner for it, but you know, these crisis management, what they will do is they'll go through and they will trawl through the internet, getting as much removed as they can. Now, I had one contact me once regarding information that I put out about a politician, and they said, "You're going to remove it, oh, we'll sue you." And well, I've had it a few times actually,
yeah, me too.
You know, and why would you even bother? I mean, things have been said about me online. My work, I don't care. Interested. People can talk to their own opinion. Good luck, crack on. You know, because it's nonsense. So why would it worry me?
Yeah.
But there is a need. They have a need to clear their name.
Yeah.
And they have a need to, and then to bring in their heavies to threaten people, and threaten them, you know, on this legal thing, and threaten them with suing, and you'll end up with a legal bill so big you'll lose your house, your home, your everything. So that's how they do it. And it's the same when you whistleblow against the government or government institution, like I found out. You know, you stand to lose everything, and they hit you so quick and so hard. It's what they call a war of attrition.
Okay.
They have the time, the resources, the muscle, the power to see it through, and you haven't. And a lot of people back down.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean they back down because they're in the wrong. It means they back down because they're tired, they're worn out, or they're just basically frightened. And this is what these snakes do. And I think that there was a desperate need to get rid of that body. There was a desperate need to get rid of it. And it had to go because it contained too much information.
Yeah.
And also, that flat, in my opinion, needed to be sterile, because what if there was medication that was conducive with doping the child? That needs to be got rid of. And if that child went missing at that actual period of time, and the police went in search, they would have found stuff. And they did. And what is clear is the dog, the cadaver dog, which had, you know, a phenomenal success track record, and went on to be a big asset to the FBI. Picked up a dead body scent from behind the couch. It picked up the same scent days later from the car.
Yeah.
Unprompted. The McCanns went out their way to discredit that dog handler, and that dog handler and his dog were the same ones that discovered the body parts that were found in Hope de la Garenne in Jersey.
Damn.
So, you know, so they went out their way to discrediting that dog. They then hindered the long-term investigation of that kid's home where children were murdered. And the police officer, Lenny Harp, who did a sterling job on that kid's home and found child remains, and they turned up and said it was coconut shell later on. Whoa. And they attacked him like they attacked me. So we see the pattern all the time, and they threaten you with so many things that you do get worried. And that's what they'll tell you they'll do to you. What is it? Wow. Then they're not going to tell you that they'll do to you, and that's what you've got to worry. And you know that there were credible reports that come through that I saw a good chance of being killed if I carried on doing what I was doing and speaking out. And that came from within Parliament. That information came from within Parliament, a good source in Parliament. And I was told. So, you know, that they'll take it, that extra step. They will.
Yeah, well, listen.
Sometimes, you know, you need to stay alive. You know, there's a parable in the Bible about the man down the well. Don't be the man down the well. You're no good down the well. You need to be free, and you need to be alive. I mean, if you're in prison, you're of no use. I mean, we look at what's happened with Wilfred Wong.
Yeah. Well, that's a story. That's a story for another night on our channel, that one. But listen, let me throw this last theory at you. So, let's just listen to this, because this is my brain sort of produced this. Let's say that the McCanns were involved in something horrible, that also some politicians were involved in too, and they were all part of the same group. And Madeline was sedated and then used for horrible things, and then died of an overdose during those horrible things. Knowing that the McCanns have information on other people because they're in the same club, would that be leverage enough for them not to put a D notice on them and for this case to have gone on so long?
But who's saying that might not be the case?
Well, it's a theory. It's just a theory. Allegedly, theory.
But it is. But the fact that he accidentally fell was, like I said, a quirk of fate. Maybe these things were going on, and her body would have held the information, the clue on the post-mortem, which would have been brought a certain degree of that to light. And sedation is used. One of the things that is used in ritual abuse is also hallucinogenics. So there's someone who come forward, and this was to do with Ted Heath's stuff and all that. And I was told that at a ritual, this person was given LSD. And so their memory recall was of like rabbits and butterflies and bizarre things. Well, where's the credibility when that person is interviewed about their recollection?
Of course.
There's no credibility, because it's, you know. So what you found was that when it comes to sexual abuse and pornography, the children would tend to be sedated, because there would be a muscle relaxant element to it as well, especially when it comes to sodomization. And also there would be the compliance, the complicity in there, because they were so drugged, there wasn't much. And when one girl told me about, she found a child porno mag, and she was in it, and she said, "You can clearly see my eyes are glazed. I'm not with it," because they were doping me. Whereas when it comes to ritual abuse, they tend to want the child lucid. Now, with ritual abuse, you can split the victims into two categories: those that are going to survive and those that are going to be sacrificed. Correct. So the sacrificial ones won't be drugs at all. They want them to experience the full horrors of torture, fear, pain, everything. Yeah. And they get off on it. It's a turn on it. It's a gift to the demons when they
Correct.
Do it.
Correct.
But those that survive it, they tend to be the intergenerational children of the intergenerational Satanists and what have you. Yeah. And the kids are used to also kill the other children.
Yeah.
And they're also used as a weapon to lure the children Correct. Into a false sense of security, the ones that are going to get killed. So they'll use a kid as a bait to get other kids in. And so there's a need. And also these children are heavily sexualized, and they know how to perform sex acts, and that is what some of them want, whereas a child who's abducted won't.
Yeah.
It'll be totally alien to them. It'll frighten them. It will scare them, which will again add to a certain element of the ritual. So, you know, it's not saying these things don't happen, but that there's a place for them and there's a method in it. But, you know, in my opinion, a lot of that may well have been going on. We don't know. Hopefully one day someone will come forward. And look, there was, I may have mentioned it, a case years ago of the street children in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro, and they were heavily involved in crime against tourists, and they were becoming a plague. They were seeing like wild dogs, like rats that were just going around and attacking tourists, and that was really affecting the economy
of
Rio. So the police had a special unit that would go around and just execute the kids.
Wow.
These Jesus. Were street kids. They were high on drugs anyway, so they weren't bothering to nick them. They're just shooting them.
Yeah, they're often.
It was unofficial. They knew it went on, but there was nothing really written down because it's highly illegal.
Yeah,
and the reason it only came out was that the head of the unit went to God. He wow. turned. He went to Jesus and he confessed everything. And it actually, that's the only way the world ever knows about these wow. things going on. Now, maybe, hopefully, one day, one of that little group will speak out. But it's
horrific.
They're at risk if they do. There is a need to silence people because it can't get out.
Yeah.
Unless it's how they keep it's the ultimate, look, paedophilia is the ultimate secret society. You know, yeah. the Freemasons have their rules regarding cutting people's gizzards out and all sorts if they say anything. And it may be a veiled threat or just some sort of, you know, bizarre historical act that they go through. But nevertheless, it's a threat. Whereas, you know, the Satanists, you know, there's a real threat yeah. to your life if you speak out. They're forever held in servitude because there are no spectators in this thing. This isn't a spectator sport. You can't just pop along to a satanic ritual and think, well, it's not really for me.
Of course.
You know, once you're in it, you're in it. And a good testimony to that is a lady called Audrey Harper. And when she talked about her introduction to Satanism via street prostitution and class A drug addiction, and she said at the first ritual she witnessed a child being killed and she was made to drink the blood.
Yeah,
and everyone had to. There was no one that didn't. You know, everyone had to, and that's what binds them together. It's a conspiracy of silence,
of course,
because they're all active participants in this abhorrence.
Yeah, but it's horrific, and just what you were saying there about the street kids in Brazil and how people are drugged and they don't remember. Phil Chalmers is someone I work with, and he often refers to targets of serial killers as the lesser dead. It's street workers, it's street kids, it's people that if they die, they're lesser cared about. You know, who really cares if a prostitute dies or street kids go missing when there's so much other crime going on? And when it comes to people being drugged and not remembering, some of you out there are going to be thinking, well, how is that possible? I would invite you to look up David Parker Ray. He was a serial killer who, one of his victims was approached by the FBI to look at her tattoos because she was a known prostitute and her tattoos were recognized by the local police in the video of her being abused and tortured. And she was kept for weeks and then released in the streets. And the cocktail of drugs she'd taken, she'd forgotten everything that had happened to her. And the only reason she knew was she was a victim is because the police knew what her tattoos looked like and went
yeah,
to
her. Yeah, I mean, I've got a statement from a street prostitute, and she goes on about how she's approached by a guy, a black guy who would also sell her drugs, and he offered her to make more money, and that would be by getting pregnant by her punters, not wearing contraception. And if she got pregnant, she could he would take care of the child. She'd be taken to a private clinic,
but
she'd give birth and her kid would go.
Wow.
And she knew eventually that the kid was going for satanic ritual abuse. There was a guy I spoke to many years ago. And I was still in the police when I interviewed this guy, and he told me of his life on the street as a rent boy throughout the 60s and 70s. And he tells about kids that would go missing, and there was one particular car that he was told never to get in, and that was a white Rolls Royce. with two brothers in, would pick up the boys from Piccadilly, the meat rack area. And he was told by his pimp, if you go in that car, you're not seen again. There's a lot of the boys that go in there, we never see him. And he actually did get in there. And he was so badly abused. They thought his lifeless corpse. It was just dumped by the Royal Free Hospital.
Jesus.
Just dumped. And he was still alive and he survived. But he had horrific internal injuries. There's a testimony of a guy called James Reeves that I took. And James, again, was the victim of a kid's home. Become a rent boy on the street. He's an old man now, and he actually gave evidence at a government inquiry. And he said his little gang on the streets of central London, they would meet up at Euston Station and then go off thieving or renting out there, you know, renting their own up as sex and that as rent boys. And he said there was him and five others, and the five went to a party. He never went. And he said they were never, ever seen again. Never seen again. Yeah, so what we're seeing is when you get the implementation of a D notice, which is a defence notice, it's a military intelligence instrument. They usually go for the 100-year because that tends to cover the lifespan, they say, of a child victim. But I think there's more nefarious reasons, and they're used very liberally in some of these cases. And never underestimate the ultimate secret society and the power that it has, and that is that of the people. Most criminals tend to be criminals that are involved in violence or dishonesty, and they tend to come from the lower and the working classes. Whereas when you've got pedophilia, it knows no boundaries. It knows no economic restrictions. It knows no religious boundaries. It just doesn't care for any of them. It's like a hot knife through the butter of society.
Yeah.
And it's which I would say connects all these, what you might think are unconnected people. If you start thinking about the secret society of paedophilia, that then you tend to have your answer.
Correct.
And it can be as base level as that. So, you know, your mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open.
And that's where the whole reason we do this show, John, is to sort of educate people on the bigger pictures and give them a chance to make up their own mind on another theory. Let us know down in the comments what you guys think. We're having to wrap up a little bit quicker. So, I'm going to make sure that next week we go a little bit deeper into this wonderful ex-policeman in his pants swimming for such a good cause. We touched on it a little bit, but, you know, I'm going to keep pushing John to get me some content to make so we can, you know, put a little bit halfway through this and do a wee advert for him. But let us know down in the comments if there's any cases you want us to cover. This is a discussion. We want to hear from you. And of course, myself, Ron Swanson, my links are in the description. Come and join me on the Project Root channel. I absolutely adore making content on this channel too. So please leave a like and let Sean know how much you love this series. And thank you, John, for giving up your time once again. Thank you all for viewing this and coming and joining us. And for me, Ron Swanson, as always, be safe out there.
Love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.